We'd like to get started. Welcome to this session. It is a session on DNA on the witness stand, and my name is Cindy Mudro. I'll be the chair for this session. What's listed in your program is D. Jeffrey Meldrum. He will not be attending today, and so we will have Trent D. Stevens, who is a professor of anatomy and embryology at the Idaho State University, presenting both Jeff's paper and his own. And we will be having Bill Evanson, who will be giving comments. He is a professor of physics at Brigham Young University. Trent also wanted me to mention that there is a book forthcoming. It's called Evolution and Mormonism, A Quest for Understanding. And in addition, Brent Evanson, we've lost our notes.
Bill Evanson, yeah.
Bill Evanston has published a number of works on this same topic. One is named Evolution. It's in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. He has compiled a BYU packet on evolution and Science, the Universe, Creation, and Evolution, which BYU Studies edition of B.H. Roberts, The Truth, the Way, and the Life. So we will get started.
Thank you, Cindy. She's going to go look for some notes. My plan was to read Jeff's talk, which he had completely printed out for me. When I set it down as I came in, the previous speaker ran off with all of our material. So let me explain why I'm up here and not Jeff. I think that the Sunstone Symposium Organizing Committee their planning was a little off because they scheduled this meeting right at the same time that Jeff's wife was expecting their sixth son. There's two ways of looking at that. One is you can say, well, this is number six, and this is a sixth boy, nonetheless, and so you've had a lot of experience, so you should be able to handle it yourself, so I'll go to the meeting. The other way to look at it is this is the sixth one, and you better be here to support me. Thank you. That's the view that won out. So Jeff is there either at the hospital or back home now. As of 10 o'clock last night, they still hadn't had the baby, but we're close. So I am here giving both presentations, and I'm going to try to read through Jeff's presentation, hopefully I will not stumble too terribly over this. Now, let me explain to you what we're going to be doing here. The book that we have written, which is coming out in September, consists of 12 chapters. Jeff's presentation covers parts of three of those chapters, and the presentation I'll be giving, which follows, is part of another chapter of this book. And so what we're going to do, first of all, is look at the scientific evidence that's accumulated primarily in the last 30 years. The title of the book that's coming out, it's a signature book publication coming out in September entitled Evolution of Mormonism, A Quest for Understanding. And so what we want to start with is DNA on the witness stand and discuss the scientific evidence that we have that's very new. Within the nucleus of each cell of one's body are packed 23 pairs of chromosomes containing the encoded information needed to initiate development, sustain life, and perpetuate one's genetic legacy. Each chromosome is composed of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA, and its associated proteins. The nucleus, with its DNA database, can be compared to a library with thousands of volumes of books. The library contains information about the cell, its structure, its function, its history, and its relatedness to other organisms. As cells continually grow and divide, copies of the DNA library of necessity replicated. During the process of copying the equivalent of thousands of volumes, errors are naturally introduced. These errors of transcription are called mutations. If a mutation occurs in a reproductive cell, it may be passed on to the offspring. Mutations may alter the expression of an existing character or introduce an altogether novel character. Most changes reduce survival, but some benefit the organism by providing an an unrealized advantage in the face of changing conditions. Some common examples: mutated insect pests become resistant to pesticides, promoting the development of more powerful and more toxic chemicals. Similarly, the abuse of antibiotics has precipitated the emergence of resistant bacteria in mounting national medical concern. The accumulation of mutations produces a relatively unique identity in the DNA of each individual and their posterity. The discovery that DNA sequences are unique among individuals and families has led to the development of a technique for identification. This technique, called DNA fingerprinting, permits a profile of key landmarks to be compared between DNA samples. The procedure takes advantage of the fact that many cells are equipped with a defense mechanism to protect against invasion by foreign DNA. This defense consists of proteins called restriction enzymes that recognize specific short sequences of foreign DNA, attach to those sites, and snip the invading strand into fragments. The resulting fragments in this technique then can be applied to an electrophoresis gel, and the electric current causes the fragments to spread along the gel to shorter fragments moving further than the longer ones. Once this gel is labeled with a dye, it produces a characteristic fingerprint of the individual, a relatively unique banding pattern produced by the varying length fragments. The evidence of DNA fingerprinting has become a powerful forensic tool in adjudications. Examples from recent headlines illustrate the role of DNA on the witness stand. DNA samples collected from a crime scene can be used to virtually establish the presence or absence of a suspect. The highly publicized O.J. Simpson trial exposed millions of people to the application of DNA evidence in a homicide case. The surprising verdict apparently resulted not from the lack of confidence in the DNA evidence, but from doubt stemming from allegations that the evidence had been planted or mishandled by detectives. Questions of family relatedness can also be determined. Recently, by means of DNA fingerprinting, remains in the tomb of the unknown Vietnam soldier in Arlington National Cemetery were identified as Air Force Lieutenant Michael Blossy and were returned to his family. Defense Secretary Cohen commented that given the advances in DNA identification techniques, the tomb of the unknown Vietnam soldier would most likely remain empty. When 9 skeletons were found in a shallow grave in Ekaterinburg, Russia, in July 1991, it was possible to identify the remains of the Tsar, his wife, 3 of their 5 children, the royal physician, and 3 servants. DNA analysis revealed an exact match between the wife and the 3 children and a living maternal relative. Similar results were achieved with the remains of the former Tsar and 2 living maternal relatives. This forensic evidence supported the hypothesis that the remains were those of the executed Romanov family. On the other hand, DNA analysis refuted the claim of the late Anna Anderson Manahan, that said she was a surviving Anastasia Romanov. Although the public was mesmerized by her story, and some even Romanov family members were quite convinced by her charade, the DNA evidence left little room for doubt that she was in fact not Anastasia. BYU scholars are sorting out the identities and genealogies of 4,000-year-old Egyptian mummies in the collections of the Rosicrucian Egyptian Museum using these techniques. Successful extraction and sequencing of DNA from the tooth pulp of a 29,000-year-old Neanderthal confirmed their close relationship to modern humans, but revealed that they are cousins rather than direct ancestors. Such applications of DNA evidence in forensic science have only become possible in the past few decades. However, in spite of the relative youth of the field of molecular biology, the data which have accumulated in the past few decades are, number one, massive. There are literally thousands of volumes of DNA sequences for humans and other organisms now available in computer databases. Number two, rapidly accumulating. Newer, faster, and more automated sequencing techniques are being developed all the time. New genes are being sequenced each and every day. the entire DNA sequences of several viruses, bacteria, and yeast are already completely known. By the year 2003, the entire human genome, consisting of about 80,000 genes, will be sequenced, and large portions of the genomes of many other plants and animals will be known. Scientists at Genoplex, a company in Denver that is studying chimp genes for medical research, suggest that chimps differ from humans in only a few hundred genes out of the some 80,000, with perhaps as few as 50 accounting for the cognitive differences between humans and chimps. They advocate a national chimp genome project in order to identify those genes that are uniquely human. Number three, the data are consistent. The DNA sequences documented for similar genes in very different organisms have been found to be remarkably similar, demonstrating that there is both consistency and continuity in structure and function at the molecular level between organisms. Number four, the data support the concept of relatedness. In the study of human DNA sequences, there is remarkable correlation between the degree of similarity in common regions of DNA and the proposed relationship between individuals, whether of a particular immediate family, extended family, tribe or clan, race or nationality. The differences between variable sequences reflect the accumulation of mutations in separate lineages since the time of their divergence from a common ancestor. The degree of sequence differences between humans and their closest relatives, the chimpanzee, indicate a divergence from a shared common ancestor between 5 and 7 million years ago. DNA hybridization is a process that uncouples the complementary strands of the DNA molecules of a species and allows them to reunite with separate strands from a species being compared. The degree to which they match is a measure of the relatedness of the two individuals or two species. When the DNA sequences of two humans selected at random from anywhere on the globe are compared, they may differ on the average by as much as one out of every 200 nucleotides. In other words, they are 99.5% similar. If the DNA sequence of a human and a chimpanzee are compared, one out of every 100 nucleotides is found to be different. In other words, they are about 99% similar. As more and more individual genes are studied, mounting DNA sequence data indicate that chimpanzees and humans are humans' nearest neighbors in the animal kingdom. The validity of conclusions drawn from the DNA evidence by forensic scientists when it comes to convicting a criminal, murderer, or rapist, identifying genealogical relations of people, both living and deceased, is well established and widely accepted. Similarly, the same techniques are employed by systematists, scientists who study the classification of living organisms, to unravel the relationships of diverse species of plants and animals. So if we look at forensic sciences, we're looking at establishment of identity, paternity, and genealogy. It is a logical extension of this approach to apply these very same techniques, accepted as authoritative in the courtroom, to the question of humans' biological legacy. Is it reasonable to discount the conclusions drawn from the very same kind of data used by forensic detectives when applied by scientists to investigate the physical relation of humans to other animals? The superficial resemblance of humans and apes has long been apparent and recognized in various cultures that were familiar with these animals. That intuitive impression was reiterated by the empirical observations of comparative anatomists. In 1699, Edward Tyson, a noted comparative anatomist, was afforded the novel opportunity to dissect and describe an infant chimpanzee that was captured in Africa and subsequently died at sea. He enumerated the obvious features in which the chimp more closely resembled humans, in contrast to those in which it more closely resembled other primates. His conclusion, not only were the human and chimp very similar in many evident respects, but the chimp more closely resembled us than it did even other apes and monkeys, the differences being reduced to matters of nuance. Never before had there been so public a demonstration of our kinship with the animals, and such attention drawn to our particular similarity to one of the apes. Tyson's observations and impressive illustrations served to dramatically narrow the perceived gulf between humans and animals. The outward similarities of human and ape are inescapable. Anyone who has frequented a zoo and peered across the moat at a stately gorilla or acrobatic chimp cannot help but be struck by the familiarity of form, feature, and gesture. In not so dissimilar fashion, we contemplate the aging portrait of a distant ancestor and note distinctive set of eyes, the cleft chin or line of the nose that leaves its mark generation after generation. These similarities are clearly more than skin deep. DNA bears mute witness to outward affinity, be it between great-great-grandparent and posterity, or extending even further back in time between the human body and other primates. The witness has testified. The evidence has been presented. The verdict seems evident to anyone willing to objectively consider it. We each possess a physical body that, regardless of how intellectualized, sanitized, deodorized, and depiliated, bears the inevitable stamp of our continuity with nature. The fingerprint of our common physical heritage with animals is self-evident. We are born, grow, consume, metabolize, eliminate wastes, sleep, reproduce, and ultimately die, just as any other biological organism on this planet. We share 99% of our distinctive DNA with our next of biological kin, the chimpanzee. Furthermore, a second testimony is added to the first. While the DNA provides the circumstantial evidence, a contemporary trace of the unity and continuity of life, the fossil record provides direct evidence for the chronological sequence of that evolutionary history. Scientists may infer relationships between living organisms based on features ranging from anatomical to molecular. They may discover the processes by which variations are introduced into living populations and by which natural selection and speciation occur. But it is the evidence of fossils that attest to the historicity of these processes by recording the succession of life forms through past ages. Although in the 19th century, there was very little known of the fossil record of human evolution, Darwin's theory distinctly predicted the existence of several extinct links between humans and apes. The only potential specimen at that time was the beetle-browed skullcap of Neanderthal man, discovered in a cave in central Germany, which was dismissed by most authorities as a physiologically misshapen modern human. But Darwin predicted specifically that humans shared a common ancestor with the African apes, and that eventually fossils of that common ancestor would be found on the African continent. In 1863, Thomas Henry Huxley reflected, "Where must we look for primeval man? Was the oldest Homo sapiens Pliocene or Miocene, or yet more ancient? In still older strata, do the fossilized bones of an ape more anthropoid or a man more pithecoid than any yet known await the researchers of some unborn paleontologist? Time will tell." Indeed, it has. In the past few decades, our knowledge of the fossil record of human evolution has virtually exploded. It is fair to say that over three-quarters of the pertinent fossils have been discovered and the ensuing literature written since 1970. Dramatic and significant fossil discoveries appear annually on the covers of Time, Newsweek, National Geographic, and numerous technical journals. It is impossible within the scope of this session to convey the entire fossil record of human evolution. It is no longer the case, as it once was commonly asserted, that all the fossil evidence of human evolution could be placed in a single shoebox with room to spare. Hominid fossils are indeed relatively rare, but there now exist tens of thousands of individual specimens in museum collections around the globe. Many are single teeth or isolated jaws, but scores are relatively complete skulls, and a number are largely complete skeletons. These examples are specifically meaningful since they postdate much of the writing by Mormons authors that are rooted in the understanding of the first half of this century. Humans are hominids, but not all hominids are human or even human ancestors. Hominids are members of the primate family Hominidae, which encompasses all bipedal, that is, two-legged primate species. that arose since the split from a common ancestor between the lineage leading to the living African apes, chimps and gorillas, and that leading to humans. This split is thought to have occurred sometime between 5 and 7 million years ago. This common ancestor has now become the elusive, quote, missing link, end quote, searched for by paleontologists today. A number of the missing links between that common ancestor and modern humans have already been found. That critical period between the divergence and about 4 million years ago has a meager representation in the known fossil record. However, the past decade has witnessed the breach of the 4 million year barrier with the discovery of the earliest known hominids. This is a significant advance as it extends the record over ever closer to the proposed last common ancestor of apes and hominids. One of these recent breakthrough discoveries is of a species called Australopithecus amanuensis, discovered in Kenya by Maeve Leakey in 1994 and dates to 4.1 million years ago. It combines relatively chimpanzee-like jaws with leg bones that indicate adaptations for bipedalism, even at this early date. Also in 1990, another even older species of hominid from Ethiopia was announced, Ardeopithecus remittis, and I'm going to slaughter some of these names because this is the area where Jeff is supposed to be here. Dating to 4.4 million years ago, a largely complete skeleton which is being prepared and has yet to be fully published. Eventual description of the pelvis, legs, and feet will reveal if and in what manner Ardeopithecus was bipedal. The Australopithecines combine a mosaic of ape-like and human-like traits, clearly satisfying the criterion of a, quote, missing link, end quote. In fact, in 1938, the London Illustrated News proclaimed, missing link, no longer missing. The most renowned and until recently the most complete Australopithecine skeleton, dubbed Lucy, was discovered by Don Johansson in Ethiopia in 1974. It belongs to the species Australopithecus afarensis and dates to 3.5 million years ago. It is of relatively small stature, being just under 3.5 feet tall, presumably a female. Males were considerably larger, reaching nearly 5 feet in height. From the waist up, Australopithecines are decidedly ape-like, with a slightly larger than chimpanzee-sized brain, 450 cubic centimeters, large teeth, conical-shaped rib cage, relatively long arms and rather curved fingers. From the waist down, they are decidedly more human-like, with a shallow, broad pelvis, valgus knees, and less divergent big toe, all evidence of upright bipedal posture. These legs, however, are relatively short and the toes rather long and curved by comparison with human standards, indicating considerable time spent feeding and or sheltering in trees. Lucy has been rivaled by the uncovering of an entirely complete skeleton of a contemporary Australopithecus afarensis at the site of Streckfontein, South Africa. Its specimen number is STW573. Further demonstrates the transitional and intermediate morphology of the Australopithecines. The earliest members of the genus of man, Homo, also came from Africa. In 1964, Lewis Leakey and colleagues announced the discovery of a fragmentary skull of a hominid with an increased cranial capacity of approximately 680 cubic centimeters, Homo habilis, or, quote, handyman, end quote, was the first known hominid to consistently use simple stone tools and include meat as a large component of its diet. In 1984, a virtually complete fossil skeleton of a younger species of Homo was discovered by Richard Leakey in Kenya, dated to approximately 1.6 million years ago. This stunning, well-preserved specimen of Homo erectus is a subadult male estimated to be about 12 years of age. It already stood nearly 5.5 feet tall and had a robust skeleton with prominent muscle markings. Its brain was intermediate in size between a chimpanzee and a human, that is 880 cubic centimeters, another, quote, missing link, end quote. The properties of the limbs are essentially human-like. but it retains features of the rib cage, vertebral column, and hips found in the Australopithecine skeleton, thus confirming its descent from these earlier hominids. Specimens of Homo erectus have been uncovered through the Old World. In addition to the shift in anatomy, there was a shift in behavior, that is, home bases, use of fire, more complex and consistent tool use, big game hunting. Transitional forms between Homo erectus and modern Homo sapiens have been referred to as archaic Homo sapiens. Some workers, however, prefer to designate them as members of a distinct species, Homo heidelbergensis. What may appear to be equivocation on the part of paleontologists simply attests to the obvious transitional nature of these specimens. The fossils display such an intermediate combination of features that opinions split as to how they can be classified. Where does one draw the line between species when the gradation between them is so continuous? Shifting opinions and delineation and naming do not alter the significance of the specimens as transitional in form and time. Homo heidelbergensis first appears about 780,000 years ago. It shows a further increase in brain size, average of about 1,250 cubic centimeters, somewhat thinner skull bones, but retains a very robust, heavily muscled skeleton. Numerous specimens have been found in Africa and throughout Eurasia. This specimen from China is a substantial skeleton that dates to 200,000 years ago. One specialized regional side branch of the Homo lineage is the much popularized Neanderthal, which appeared in isolated Western Europe about 120,000 to 130,000 years ago. Their disposition of sheltering in caves has resulted in the preservation and recovery of numerous essentially complete skeletons, and originally gave rise to the term caveman. In 1993, Italian spelunkers entered a sealed cave and discovered an apparently complete early Neanderthal skeleton nestled among the stalagmites, partly encrusted with limestone. These hominids had brains of a size to rival or exceed modern humans, although the organization may have differed. Physically, they remained quite distinct, with rather squat, extremely robust, heavily muscled skeletons, broad, less dexterous hands, low brows, and prominent faces. Culturally, they were also distinct, lacking in art objects and adornments which one would expect to be preserved under the conditions of their skeletal interment. As noted earlier, their DNA indicates they had little or no genetic exchange with their physically modern human contemporaries. By as early as 200,000 years ago, modern Homo sapiens had emerged, distinguished by their gracile skeletal structure, high foreheads, and small teeth and jaws. In 1988, an absolute date was determined for a site in the Middle East, which in 1965 had yielded several well-preserved modern human skulls. The Quafsa skulls, 92,000 years old. Additional modern finds in this time range have been established throughout Africa. By 35,000 years ago, sites in Europe yielded modern humans associated with a complex and sophisticated toolkit, bone sewing needles, and other implements. Art objects were also found, as well as musical instruments and elaborate cave paintings. The cover of the October 1988 issue of the National Geographic magazine featured the carved ivory bust of a rugged man's face, a self-portrait perhaps. The ivory was dated to 26,000 years ago and originated from a locality in former Czechoslovakia that had long produced Neolithic artifacts, as well as in 1986 three complete skeletons and a multiple ceremonial burial. These were modern human beings, virtually indistinguishable from you and me in bodily form and inferred mental abilities, with a sense of self, an appreciation of aesthetics and spiritualism, and a reverence for the dead. They were apparently of our species, which has inhabited this planet for nearly 100 millennia. This is a brief sketch of the hard evidence of human evolution, the fossilized bones and teeth and stone tools of early hominids and humans. To this we could add the flood of information contributed by paleoclimatologists, paleobotanists, ecologists, geologists, archaeologists, and numerous other scientific disciplines that contribute to an interpretation of the context and significance of these fossil specimens. The fossils and artifacts provide a compelling drama of the evolution of rather ape-like bipedal hominids from which a lineage emerged that subsequently evolved into beings physically indistinguishable from modern humans. The search for the, quote, missing link, end quote, has yielded not one but numerous links at more and more finely distinguished levels of transition, to the point that boundaries become the types or species become blurred and ambiguous. The history of human evolution is one of the best examples of transitional evolution in the fossil record. This record written in stone, combined with the witness of the DNA sequence data, the case for the physical continuity of the human body with the whole of nature does not rest, but continues to accumulate evidence as knowledge is poured out upon us. Thank you.
At this point, we have the same speaker twice, and so maybe we'll open up for about 5 minutes of question and maybe comment, and then go back to Trent for his presentation.
And then we can discuss both of these later on as well. Yes? What we're looking at is if we look at the person next to you, unless they're your sister or brother, you're about 99.5% similar to them if we look at just the DNA. If we look at the chimps, we're looking at 99%. Neanderthal is in between that range. So when we say they're quite dissimilar from us, that's a quite relativistic statement. So, yeah, we're looking at that 5/10% gap. Yeah, they are closer to us than the chimpanzees. Yes. And it's randomness? First of all, let me try to discuss this in a couple of ways. Oh, repeat the question. The philosophic implications of natural selection, its apparent randomness. I'm going to say three things about that. First of all, mutation is essentially random. And I qualify that slightly because there are hot spots in the genome that are more sensitive to mutation than others. But for the most part, we can say that it's a random process. Natural selection, on the other hand, is not a random process. I think it's important to understand that distinction. And one example might be to say that if you took a young boy with a BB gun with an unlimited supply of BBs, had him stand and shoot in a 360-degree circle, what he hit would be random. But if there was one window somewhere within the range of fire, eventually that window would be hit and broken. That would be selection then. So within this large milieu of random mutation is the opportunity for natural selection, which is not a random process. And then thirdly, one of the things that I have been looking at, another chapter that we address in the book, I'll talk about it briefly in my presentation next, but we won't spend any time on it. We can certainly discuss it later, is the idea that there are, in addition to the non-randomness of natural selection, there are very significant constraints on possible shapes. One experiment that I conducted in my laboratory was published just a year ago this spring, looks at that issue of how random is the placement of, say, limbs on the body. That's my area of expertise, my area of research. So the question is, are limbs placed on the body randomly, or is that established by some mechanism, perhaps a non-genetic mechanism? And the answer is that it's that the position of the limbs is determined by the overall architecture of the embryo. So it's a mechanical phenomena. Therefore, it becomes a non-random, non-genetically impacted phenomena. So we have several layers on both sides of natural selection we can look at. There's a question in the back. Yes? Okay. The question was, what do we see that's next to the chimpanzee, and where do other animals such as pigs and crocodiles fit into that scheme? It's really quite interesting. One can take the DNA sequences of various both plants and animals and line them up, and you can look at the extreme end of the spectrum and look at the similarities or dissimilarities, if you will, between us and plants, we get down to within a functional gene. If we share a functional gene, say with a plant, then the similarity is only about 50%, even within that gene. Between genes, it almost disappears. If we look at other animals, the next down the line would be something like a monkey. The apes would be in between chimpanzees and monkey. But if you look at a monkey, the similarity is about 98% with our genome. So you don't drop down very fast. When you look at something like a pig or a horse or cow or dog, a quadruped, then you've dropped down another 3 or 4%. So we're dropping down not very rapidly. Even when you stay within mammals, we're still well over 90% similar in the DNA sequences. You get down to something like a crocodile, reptile, we drop down another 5 or 10%. So you can actually construct a hierarchy that is absolutely predictable by our the nomenclature that pre-existed all of the molecular data. These are based on surveys. It's just like predicting a political outcome, the outcome of the vote. Yes. What we're doing is taking samples and then expanding that to the rest. The more samples we take, the closer we are found that we're linked rather than the farther apart. We find that the older estimates are actually too far off, that we're actually more close related the more we look at it.
Probably one more question.
Okay. One more question. Then we have time for other questions after my paper as well.
Do you get in your book to the issue?
Yeah, that's... The question is, in our book, do we get into the issue of self-organizing systems, chaos theory, and their relation to things like natural selection? The answer is yes, and that's really where my area of interest in this whole field lies, and that's like the next to the last chapter in our book.
Are you going to comment on that today?
I'm not directly, but I certainly can at the end, or we can talk about it separately.
Do you want to begin your paper?
Sure.
Trent will now present his paper, and we'll leave some time for further questions at the end.
I'll just put on a different hat.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see. I need to advance this quite a ways, I think. Whoops, not that far. Okay. What I'm going to talk about next, if we look at what Jeff has just presented, the issue of our relatedness to nature, and we're looking at now two witnesses that have taken the witness stand and have presented rather compelling evidence that we're related to nature. There are really two reasons that we began this project of writing this book. One was that as instructors, both of us teach anatomy. I teach developmental biology in addition, and Jeff teaches evolution in addition. And as you can well imagine, we have had many students come to us and ask us what our feeling is as active members of the LDS Church and as also biologists, and we both view ourselves as evolutionary biologists. And we can talk to those students, and in fact, one of those students that came to us a number of years ago, I think it's been about 8 years ago now, is the third author on the book. He's the one that talked us into doing this project in the first place. But we can talk to these students, but after we're finished, there's really no modern book that we could send them to complete their understanding of the church's current position on these issues and where we are coming from on these various issues to fill in the gaps. The other purpose for writing this book, and in particularly the chapter I'm going to be dealing with here, comes from a number of debates and panel discussions that I've had with creationists. Most of the time, the debates center around the scientific issues. And the problem that we have found, or that I have personally found in debating the scientific issues, is that quite often the audience is not sophisticated enough to understand how far off base the creationist argument is when it comes to the scientific issues, because they stand up and make absolutely flat, bold statements. I was watching the movie on the Nuremberg trials a couple of weeks ago, and it reminded me of the way the creationists present things, and that is to stand up much like Goering did and just make flat-out black and white statements that have no substance and truth at all. The problem is the audience doesn't recognize that that's happening. So one of the things that I decided to do is to take the debate away from the scientific arena and put it into the religious arena and see what happens to the debate when we do that. That's the intent of this next discussion, the issue of the tree of life as it relates to our previous discussions. If you remember only one thing, or three things, I guess that is, from this presentation, I hope you remember these three words: search the scriptures, with the word search being emphasized here, as opposed to reading superficially as you're falling asleep. Okay, the two major problems that contribute to the perceived rift between evolution and religion is, number one, what we've been talking a little bit about, and that is the random nature of the process. As many evolutionary biologists claim, how can there be order in the universe if such is the case? How could God have been in control of a process if the outcome is unpredictable? How could we have been created in God's image as a result of a random evolutionary process? That's just to tantalize you a little bit. I'm not going to talk about that. Item number two, you have to buy our book. It's coming out next month. Number two, if Adam and Eve came into being as a result of evolutionary processes descended from the hominids we've talked about, how could they have been immortal? If they were not immortal, how could you explain the fall? If there was no fall, what was the mission of Jesus? If there was no fall and no atonement, then there is no Christianity. So we have a dilemma. We can look at the scriptures in at least three different ways. One is that the scriptures are entirely literal, in which case there's no conflict at all with science. Because there was no literal Adam and Eve, we don't have to worry about the Garden of Eden or the fall as being a literal event. Second, we can take a little bit of literal and a little bit of literary, which is what most people do, and they salt them together depending on their own purposes, which creates a possible conflict with science. That is, an example of the literary is that Eve was made from Adam's rib, which many people have argued was just figurative. Or we could take it as all being absolutely literal, which obviously also creates a possible conflict with science. And there's no room for interpretation in that case. Now, if we look at the Garden of Eden as a paradisiacal state, where do you find that word in the scriptures? Referring to the Garden of Eden? Take a look when you get home. Get a good big concordance or use one of your search engines and look for paradisiacal. God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. How can the scientific data, which suggests that we descended from animals that lived and died on this planet for millions of years, be reconciled with the religious perspective of Adam and Eve as first humans were immortal? We could see at least two distinct possibilities concerning the nature of their immortality. Number one, either Adam and Eve were created inherently immortal, or Adam and Eve were created as mortals and were made immortal by the circumstances within the garden. This is the question that I'm going to raise throughout this presentation. If Adam and Eve were inherently immortal, what was the function of the tree of life in the Garden of Eden? First of all, I want to point out that we, and I'm talking about Jeff, myself, and Forrest Peterson, who is the third author on this book project, We believe that there was an atonement necessitated by the fall. We believe that the fall was a change in Adam and Eve from an immortal condition. We also believe that Adam and Eve were immortal before the fall. Which brings us to a concept that's been described by a number of authors called the pillars of faith, which include the creation, the fall, and the atonement. And we agree with this concept. Now let's just ask the question of the nature of Adam and Eve's immortality. We have two possibilities. At least Adam and Eve were inherently immortal, that is, created de novo as immortal beings, or they were not inherently immortal, but were made immortal by their circumstances, by partaking of the fruit of the tree of life. One of the things that's very interesting here is the scriptures do not distinguish between these two possibilities. They don't tell us. The common assumption by tradition is that they are inherently immortal. And here's a couple of examples. Robert Woodward, in a recent Ensign article, said, they were placed on earth as immortal beings. No scriptural reference given. This is Elder Bruce R. McConkie's statement. The initial creation was paradisiacal. Death and mortality had not yet entered the world. There was no mortal flesh upon the earth for any form of life. Not just Adam and Eve, but it extends now to any form of life. Now, if we look at the scriptures, first of all, if you look up immortality, this whole notion that Adam and Eve were inherently immortal or that that everything else was immortal before the fall, if you find one, tell me, please. We have looked for such scriptures extensively and have not found it. Anybody that makes reference to it quotes this scripture from 2 Nephi 2:22, in which Lehi stated, "And now behold, if Adam had not transgressed, he would not have fallen, but he would have remained in the Garden of Eden, and all things which were created must have remained in the same state in which they were after they were created, and they must have remained forever and had no end." So here we have a notion not only that Adam and Eve were immortal, but that all things were immortal. What does the all things mean in this scripture? "And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat." Thank you. And here's one of those fruits. And here's what this fruit looks like after it's been eaten, or the part that you don't eat. Now, how could all things have remained exactly in the same state in which they were created if they were able to eat bananas? That's one of those all things. Now, if you read the next two or three verses down, you start getting the impression that what Lehi was talking about in all things is all things relating to Adam and Eve. That as long as they stayed in the Garden of Eden and had not transgressed, they would have remained in the state in which they were. Because it starts talking about them and their children in the next few verses. So all things probably Lehi probably didn't have in mind bananas when he mentioned all things. So let's go back to that scripture. If Adam had not transgressed, he would not have fallen, but would have remained in the Garden of Eden. So that now we're talking about Adam, what his situation is here. "And all things which were created must have remained in the same state in which they were after they were created, and they must have remained forever and had no end. And they would not have known good and evil, and they would not have had children," as the next few verses go on to talk. It looks very much like we're talking about Adam and Eve here and not literally all things. Okay, now let's go back to our original question. If Adam and Eve were inherently immortal and had no need to be maintained in a mortal state, then what was the function of the tree of life in the Garden of Eden? Lehi says, to bring about his eternal purposes in the end of man after he had created our first parents and the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air, and in fine all things which are created, it must needs be that there was an opposition, even the forbidden fruit in opposition to the tree of life, the one being sweet and the other bitter. So we have two trees here that Lehi is talking about that are opposition. That's a very clear image. And Alma said, we see that Adam did fall by partaking of the forbidden fruit according to the word of God. If it had been possible for Adam to have partaken of the fruit of the tree of life at that time, there would have been no death. Now let's think about this opposition that we were just talking about before. If Adam and Eve were inherently immortal, then the only opposition was between partaking of the tree of knowledge and not partaking of the tree of knowledge. Because the tree of life would have had no bearing on the issue. The reason the tree of life had a bearing on the opposition is, as Alma said, that tree was capable of giving Adam and Eve life. Why would you have a tree capable of giving Adam and Eve life if they already were immortal? Therefore, the Lord sent him forth from the Garden of Eden. What was the immediate consequence of the fall? I love to ask students this question. We've talked about some of these issues in experimental classes that we've run a couple of times. The common answer is mortality was the immediate result of the fall and being cast out of the garden. That's not what the scriptures say. What the scriptures say is that the immediate consequence was that Adam and Eve were expelled from the Garden of Eden and forcefully separated from the tree of life. Cherubim and a flaming sword was placed to guard the way of the tree of life. How many places in the scripture has God placed an armed guard in front of something? Including the Ark of the Covenant, which apparently was a dangerous thing. There's only one place in all the scriptures where there's been an armed guard placed in front of something, and that was the tree of life. Lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. If Adam had been able to get back to the tree of life, he would have been able to eat the fruit of that and live forever. Even after he had partaken of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So it didn't put mortal blood into Adam. It didn't make Adam a mortal being. It separated him from the tree of life because he got kicked out of the Garden of Eden. The scriptures state that after partaking of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, Adam could still have partaken of the fruit of the tree of life and continued to live forever. It is our opinion, therefore, that tree was in the midst of the garden so that Adam and Eve could partake of its fruit and maintain their immortality. If it were necessary for them to maintain their immortality, then it is logical to conclude that they were not inherently immortal. It is possible that the widespread belief in the church that Adam and Eve were inherently immortal is then apparently a carryover from our sectarian heritage, which has not been cast off in light of the greater revealed truth which we have been given. Where in the world did that idea come from? If the sectarian world believes in the Bible and we cannot find in the Bible that Adam and Eve were inherently immortal, where does it come from? Well, there's a prophet that's missing here. The book of Milton. John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost between 1658 and 1663, said for God, because God didn't bother to say it for himself, I, at first, with two fair gifts created him endowed, with happiness and immortality. This is the only scripture that I'm aware of where you can find that statement. Neither happiness or immortality are listed in the Bible as being inherent characteristics of Adam and Eve. Milton filled in that problem. Yes? That's what Brigham Young taught. That's correct. We can talk about that, yes. It didn't make it into the scriptures. This is what Milton then said about the fall, because he realized that he had created a paradox here. He put words into God's mouth. Quote, lest therefore his now bolder hand reach also to the tree of life and eat and live forever. Ha! Dream at least to live forever, because Milton knew that he couldn't do that under his conditions. To remove him, I decree, and send him from the garden forth to till the ground whence he was taken fitter soil. But why do we put cherubim in front of the tree? And on the east side of the garden place cherubic watch and guard all passage to the tree of life, lest paradise a receptacle prove to spirits foul, and all my trees there prey, with those stolen fruit man once more to delude. So we're going to keep Satan and his cohorts out of the garden with cherubim and the flaming sword. There's no need to keep Adam out of the garden, Because Milton knew that given the construct that he had created, all you had to do is take of the fruit and you became mortal. The tree of life had no bearing on it at all. In Milton's analogy, and in most modern traditions that we have in the church, what is the purpose of the tree of life? What function could it possibly have in the Garden of Eden? Lastly, let me simply emphasize this statement by Isaiah. Their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. Now, we normally think of that scripture as referring to modern science and philosophy teaching the precepts of men, but I would argue that people like John Milton were teaching precepts that are not contained in the scripture, and we need to be very careful about how those scriptures, how those precepts become traditions that supplant what is actually in the scriptures. What's interesting about this exercise is that we find that if we look at the scientific data here, tradition over here, and where the scriptures land, if we can eliminate the tradition, the rift between the scriptures and the scientific data are not that great. If we look, let me go to the one question that was asked about the transplantation notion, which again isn't in the scriptures. But if we look at this whole idea of Adam and Eve being transplanted from some other planet, unless all of the rest of the plants and animals on this planet were simultaneously transplanted from that other planet, which simply begs the question, moves it to some other sphere, then we should see alien DNA in ourselves. We should be the descendants of aliens. We should not be the descendants of the nature of this planet. That is not what we see at all. So unless we were all transplanted in mass, then we have a difficult time dealing with that kind of a notion, which again is a precept that is taught, that's been taught by tradition. It's not in the scriptures. I would say let's stick to the scriptures and study them and apply that test to both tradition and the scientific data. Thank you. Do you want me to take a couple questions now, first?
Shall I make some comments, and then we'll have questions on all of it?
Let's have Bill make some comments first.
Yeah, we'll have Bill make some comments first, and then there'll still be about 15 minutes for questions of both.
Or longer.
Or longer.
Somebody want to flip that slide projector off?
I don't tend to talk very long. I hope we do have quite a bit of time for questions, but I'm grateful to Trent and Jeff for helping to bring us up to date on the important scientific issues relating to human origins. As I read preliminary drafts of their papers, I was reminded of something that B.H. Roberts said when he wrote in 1928 in The Truth, the Way, the Life, which book has just been published about 5 years ago. In fact, two publications of it, finally. But he reviewed a lot of the evidence for human origins and hominid evolution, and felt that we had to take it very seriously, and said that if we do take it seriously, we shall make it possible to all Christendom and the world to see a way to harmony between the Bible facts of revelation and the truths revealed by science, which is but the facts discovered by human research early array. On the other hand, to limit and insist upon the whole of life and death to this side of Adam's advent to the earth some 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, as proposed by some, is to fly in the face of the facts so indisputably brought to light by the researcher of science in modern times. And this as set forth by men of the highest type in the intellectual and moral world, not inferior men, or men of sensual and devilish temperament, but men who must be accounted as among the noblest and most self-sacrificing of the sons of men, of the type whence must come the noblest sons of God, since the glory of God is intelligence, and that too the glory of man. These searchers after truth are of that class, to pay attention to and to give reasonable evidence, credence to their research and findings, is to link the Church of God with the highest increase of human thought and effort. On that side lies development, on the other lies contraction. It is on the former side that research work is going on and will continue to go on. Future investigation and discoveries will continue on that side. Nothing will retard them, and nothing will develop on the other side. One leads to narrow sectarianism. The other keeps the open spirit of a world movement with which our new dispensation began. As between them, which is to be our choice? Well, I think the choice is even clearer today than it was in 1928 when B.H. Roberts wrote that. I think it's clear that one must take seriously the traces of God's handiwork in nature. And by taking such things seriously, we enlarge our understanding without undermining our faith. Faith is threatened only, in my opinion, by dogmatic positions that refuse to acknowledge new scientific understanding. I think it's important, however, to be aware of the limits of our knowledge, because it's clear that our knowledge is developing. We don't have a full understanding of the scientific evidence, and we'll never have a full understanding, but we believe that it's growing. On the other hand, we also don't have a full understanding of revealed truths. Our understanding of the scriptures changes as our understanding of nature changes as we get additional revelation. But the revelations aren't always clear, and there are many things that have been that are interpreted differently today than they were 100 years ago. Another point I'd like to just mention briefly is that I think it's clear when one looks carefully that LDS doctrine is inconsistent in many ways with modern creationism, and that it's a big mistake for members of the LDS Church to put themselves in the camp of the creationists. We do not believe in ex nihilo creation, which is a foundation stone for much of modern creationism. We take science seriously and seek to reconcile our understanding of science and religion, and so on. I could say more, but I think that's the real issue. Now, there was a question a little earlier about non-randomness or randomness of natural selection. Of course, natural selection is a directed process that selects among random mutations to select those that improve or increase fitness. There was a statement in an earlier draft of Jeff's paper, which I think bears on this, and which I hope that they will expand upon in their book, since they didn't talk about it today. But he talked about finding stone tools and other evidence of Homo, the genus Homo, and he says such correlations between environmental events and the appearance of new species are gaining increasing support and are suggestive of the Abrahamic account of creation in which the physical environment is manipulated to promote the process of creation. Well, I hope that they can expand on that. I think that I can see in a vague way what's meant, but it's certainly true that natural selection makes use of environmental pressures to select out from among the many random mutations that may occur. The only other point I really want to make is that in Trent's discussion of the Tree of Life and the immortality of Adam and Eve, this actually comes very close to some things that B.H. Roberts wrote about in The Truth, the Way, the Life. And I think that the connection is quite interesting. He says that in trying to discuss his differences with Joseph Fielding Smith at the time of the writing of The Truth, the Way, the Life, he says, "I'm pleased to say that Elder Smith makes this declaration that Adam was not a resurrected being, for it makes it possible for me to add, then he was not an immortal being. For the only way to the status of immortality, sometimes referred to as eternal life, is through mortality and the resurrection from death to immortality. The resurrected Christ is the true type and ensample of an immortal man. Deathless, he can die no more." He goes on to define immortal, that if Adam had the possibility of death, which we know he did because he died, that he couldn't be called immortal. That may be a question of terms, but B.H. Roberts did treat these things in a way that's quite interesting, that ties in closely to what Trent has been telling us about. Well, I've enjoyed this very much. I think we want to leave as much time as possible for questions, so thank you.
Does this work? Yep.
Let me just comment on Bill's statement about B.H. Roberts. I have 12 years of schooling beyond high school, and then that was 25 or so years ago, and I've been continuing to learn ever since. And Sunday I hope to meet B.H. Roberts because I know a little bit about his background and his schooling. He could have written our book in 1928. And here it's taken us all this long with all this education to try to get there. Sure.
Why do we have to maintain the fiction of Adam and Eve, thus forcing us to engage in intellectual contortionism, and in order to fit some of these assumptions that we've made? And I think the answer, if I can answer that question myself, and of course you can make a comment about it, is the fact that I think that we've made some prior assumptions, I think, that are contrary to our scientific training, and then we've had to fit the evidence around those prior assumptions. I'm speaking of the assumption of the fall and the atonement. If you would like to make a comment about that.
Well, I think that if one accepts the scriptures, one has to accept Adam and Eve. And if one accepts, in addition, the official statements of the first presidency who declared Adam and Eve as the primal parents of our race, we have to accept Adam and Eve, and there's a place for them. And I don't see that there has to be a conflict with science. Of course, it's possible to take the kind of position that you take or that you suggest there, but not if one takes the scripture seriously.
One other addition I would like to make to that answer, and that's why I had the third slide that I had up there with the idea of a literary interpretation of the scriptures, and certainly one can take that, in which case there is no conflict between science and religion because the latter is a myth in every sense of the word. The other alternative is to take a literal approach, and there's two reasons for doing this. There's two reasons that we have decided to do this, and the first is that most people with whom we discuss these issues take a literal perspective, i.e. the creationists and people within our own church who are very conservative take a literalist perspective. I tend to lean in that direction myself. And contrary to what you said, what we have done, what I do in science, as a scientist, I have two things that I can do. I have data, which are hard facts. I have to make certain assumptions about those facts. I have to assume that the data are correct, and they may be skewed by the mechanisms that I use to acquire those data. But I have to make the assumption that they're correct, and then I can make interpretations of them. Now, we can do the same thing in religion. We can say that we're going to start on a basic assumption, as we might do in mathematics with certain postulates, and we assume that they are true without further proof, and then we go from there to make assumptions. I don't think it's necessary to go through contortions. In fact, the whole purpose of this talk was to argue that the traditions are where the contortions have come in. If we look at the scriptures, they're much more straightforward, even if we take a literal perspective of it. And as Bill said, it's up to the individual, either take a literary or literal view.
Well,
yeah, but I'm not sure the last leap is a logical leap, that Adam and Eve would have had the same DNA as God. What the question was is the relationship between God, Mary, and Jesus, and Adam and Eve, whether there was any alien DNA involved here. I think that the best way to answer that question is to say that if we look at a human, an alien hominid creature, it would be very interesting to look at the DNA of that creature. And I'm working on this on a totally different route, another book project that I'm working on. For one thing, one of the things that's really quite interesting about the Human Genome Project is, as far as we are down the road, and as much as we think we know, and Bill alluded to this idea that we don't know, we still have a long way to go in understanding. One of the things we don't understand at all about what makes us human is the organization of the DNA into chromosomes. Why do we have 46 chromosomes? What's significant about that? What's significant about the organization of the DNA within those chromosomes? And are the rearrangements, say, if we look at chimpanzee chromosomes and human chromosomes, we see some inversions, we see some deletions, et cetera. What's the significance of those? One of the ideas being that if we're 99% similar to chimpanzees, the greatest difference is in the organization of the chromosomes. So if we look at an alien and the alien looks remarkably like us, then could we make some assumptions about what the chromosomes look like? And I'll leave it at that, because I don't know. I've probably already said more than what I know.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
I'm Dr. Lou Wallace. I have given papers at Sunstone, and one a few years back was called The Garden in Eden. My recommendation to all of you is to get your King James Bible out, turn to verse Genesis 2:4, and damn it, read it clear through to verse 4:2, and read it carefully. There were two trees in that garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, and the tree of immortal life. After the talking snake convinced Eve to take of the fruit, and she gave to some to Adam, God said that there would be the possibility existed then for them to take from the second tree of life and be immortal, and so they were banished. This was not a fall. This is, you're getting St. Augustine and St. Jerome from the Catholic Church mixed in here. They had disobeyed, but they were not driven out. They were banished, and the flaming sword cherubim was put there. Our subsequent scripture given by the prophet Joseph Smith says that they rejoiced in that decision. But I just want to say, read that carefully. Incidentally, that word rib, sila, means side, and it's used three times in the Old Testament more, so that the Lord took a side from the Adam, not Adam, the Adam, and made a, you put an A on the feminine, made a woman from a side of the man, and I ask you, which side?
Thank you. I think that's an important bottom line to read. Yes? Well, that's certainly a possibility, but it's something, it's a possibility. Oh, the idea being that random mutation is not a scientific concept, but is a philosophical concept. That it all could be in the direction of God, the non-randomness of the process. And certainly from a philosophical perspective, one could argue that, but not from a scientific perspective. And to say that the question of randomness is outside of the realm of science, anything that's historic is outside the realm of science. Anything that happened yesterday, as recently as 10 seconds ago, we can't deal with in science. But we can deal with what's going on right now. We can look at mutations that are occurring now, and we can look at whether or not they have some kind of order to them or whether or not they're random. And we can analyze that in the laboratory, and we can evaluate the process now. To extrapolate that historically is something that is done philosophically.
Let me take the... Let me take that one step further, though, because we can see today in the laboratory and in the field creation of species. Species are created by processes in which the mutations that occur are random. So it is not an unreasonable extrapolation, although I admit that it's an extrapolation, that these same kinds of processes produced random mutations in the past. But God can direct evolution through natural selection rather than through a non-randomness of mutations.
And obviously, you know, there is natural selection because, you know, bad things don't provide.
Well, one last comment on that. There have been a couple of papers written in some of the leading scientific journals on the non-randomness of the mutation process. People have looked at that. There are examples where people have found what they describe as non-random processes. That seems to be under fairly unique circumstances, but certainly they exist. And one of the characteristics of science is that if you don't agree with the current status of the baseline of data and our interpretation of it, you're more than welcome to go out and generate more data. And we'll look at it. Back in the back. I'm not sure. Yeah, the question is if we look at a fossil that was a couple of hundred thousand years old and was 5.5 feet tall, then why do we find that the average height was somewhat less than that? You said a foot less. I'm thinking more like 6 inches less than that for some time thereafter, even up until just within the last century or so. And you mentioned nutritional factors. There are a whole bunch of factors that contribute to height, obviously, of a population. One is that I think if you were to go back and look, for example, at the entire history of the Watusis, I think you would be hard-pressed to find an era, if we went back to, say, the turn of the 19th century or 18th century, when a lot of Europeans were fairly short in stature. I don't think you would find that to be the case for the Watusis. I think if you looked at their ancestral line, you would find that they remained fairly tall. It's interesting that this particular fossil was found on the west coast of Africa. I don't know how closely related it is or not, but that may be an answer. We tend to look at the world through European eyes. And I think if we looked at the Orientals, we would find that both the fossils and the history there would be of a shorter people, certainly. The Europeans went through a period when there was a considerable shortening, probably because of nutritional factors. They had almost painted themselves into a corner from the kind of crops they were raising and the food that they were eating. And we've seen the rebound of being able to go back to a better nutrition, but I don't think that's a worldwide phenomenon. I think we have to look at various populations in various places and look at height trends there rather than taking general assumptions from the European population.
One more question.
Yes, the lady on the aisle.
The reason I wanted to set up here is that I had something very interesting happen a few years ago with respect to the church's position on evolution. I had heard that if you inquired at the church office building about what the church's official position was, that they gave you a statement which is essentially the text from the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. And it's I'm sure you've heard it. It says, let scientists do science and we'll magnify our callings in the gospel. And it ends with this statement that Adam is the primal parent of the race. But it's a very neutral statement toward evolution. And we had a very prominent creationist in our stake. He was former state president, and because of that, I had written this letter, and I first called them, and they said that I would have to write a letter. So I sent the letter, and a few days later, I got a letter back from F. Michael Watson, which told me that a letter answering my question had been sent to my stake president, and that if I would call him and inquire, identify myself as the person who raised the question about evolution, he would read the answer to me. So I did that, and when I called him, he had a letter that was written by Thomas Monson, and it said, you may read this letter to the person who inquired or to anyone else who answered or to anyone else who asks you, but you're not to show the letter to anyone or give anyone a copy. And because I had an idea what was going to be in this, I had the Encyclopedia of Mormonism text right in front of me. And he proceeded to read me a statement which was almost word for word out of the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. I was able to write down all of the differences, so I know exactly what the letter said. I thought it was so interesting that they would go to all this trouble to try to sort of have their creationist cake and repudiate it too, in the sense that they wanted to make a statement that was not an anti-scientific statement, and yet at the same time, they don't want to publicly disavow these creationist ideas. And I just wonder if you have any comments about that kind of attack.
Sure. Let me comment on that. First of all, in writing the book that we did, we thought about exactly the same issue, because there are lots and lots of letters circulating out in the church. Probably the most famous one is the David O. McKay letter. And I think that's the reason the First Presidency is very hesitant to have people circulating anything and as official church statements, other than what's been stated. Now, what we did is, at the time that we wrote this book, I was a first counselor in the bishopric. I'm now a bishop in the same ward, but at that time we were the first counselor. And so, rather than writing to the First Presidency ourselves, I went to my bishop and I said, "Here's what we're doing. We would like a statement from the First Presidency." And what we got back, and in fact, the bishop was sent a letter saying that here is the official position of the church, but it's not for copying or for distribution. And it's Bill's essay in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. It's a Xerox copy of it. But at the beginning of the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, it says this is not the official position of the church. But what we did is, in our book, we said we have reprinted the statement in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism in the appendix of our book so that everybody can look at it. And we said, I mean, we went through exactly the description of what I just told you, that even though in the beginning of the Encyclopedia of Mormonism it says this is not the official statement, if you do the same thing we did, you will get the same results that we did, and don't bother because we've already done it for you. So that's why we did it. We have a whole chapter on the church's official position and exactly what's been said about it. We have another chapter about what other general authorities have said about that position, and we've gone through all of those, I think, all those issues.
Is the official position what's being taught in seminary?
No. Depends on the seminary.
Is there an official seminary position?
We've seen a few things circling around. Yeah. I can't say.
Yeah.
Bill, do you have any better
comments?
No, we don't know about that. But I do find it distasteful that sometimes the official channels have to preserve deniability. But, yeah.
Well, I'd like to thank all our presenters, both absent and present. Thank you very much. And remind everyone that if you are here because of a ticket and you didn't drop that in before you came in, would you please drop in your ticket to the box outside? And tapes are available of this session in the book area after. Thank you.